We have two cases on our 1030 docket. We will proceed through both cases, one after the other. First case is Rayburn versus State. If the clerk will announce counsel who will be arguing today, please. All right, Mr. Greenwood.
Justice, may I move the tripod closer?
Sure, thank you. Yes, we like to be able to see it too.
If it pleases the court, may it please the court, Chief Justice Livingston, Justice McCoy, Justice Gabriel. This appeal is an appeal on the sufficiency of the evidence implicating two convictions for retaliation. The indictment significantly, I think, states that the threats that are implicated were made verbally over the telephone, constituted unlawful acts, which involved shooting and killing Kevin Taylor and Lane Ake. And Kevin Taylor is the former store manager for the AT&T store in Wichita Falls. And Lane Aiken is a security chief for the regional AT&T sector. Now, these issues involve threats of unlawful conduct. Our issues, actually, we raise in the appeal are threats, whether the threats were of unlawful conduct, if the act, if unlawful, entailed, in fact, shooting and killing. And finally, I think, most importantly for this court's decision, if the evidence can support a rational inference of the intent to retaliate, result-oriented or specific intent, is held by this court's precedent in NRA BPH. I believe this case is unique in jurisprudence of retaliation in the state of Texas, and that the decision may have wider ramifications extending the area of law into corporate customer relations conflicts with consumers. I think for that reason, the case is potentially very important. Several observations at the outset. First of all, the statute here to be construed protects public service, Secondly, where identical threats under identical circumstances, and I'm going to call these fungible threats to have an easy handle for them, are made before and after the accused learns of a report to the police, is that sufficient to infer retaliatory intent? And I would point out that nowhere in any case in the jurisprudence can you find that the ability to infer retaliatory intent is predicated upon a totality test. If affirmed going forward, will the report of a customer's conduct to the police by a retailer, a company, whatnot, put the customer on notice by law that any threat made thereafter will be effectively presumed retaliatory, even if the conduct of the defendant is the same prior to that report and after the report, indistinguishable throughout? And maybe in simple speak, how do we tell a really angry person from someone who intended to create the specific consequence of inhibiting public service? Now, on shooting or killing, I'll address this briefly, and this is not because for any other reason except that I've got a limited time. Let's be sure that we have a threat to kill here. Dual versus State, if you look to Dual versus State, I think that's all you need in shooting or killing. A second persuasive case, for many reasons, is in matter of MMR, 932 Southwest 2nd 112, an El Paso appellate court decision of 1996. Doyle, of course, is a Court of Criminal Appeals decision rendered in bank from 1983. Doyle, the court noted that an insufficient proof of a threat to kill would be as follows, for example, or Dan Gibbs won, when I get out of here, I will just have to get my gun. Okay, that by law is an insufficient threat from which an intent retaliatory intent can be inferred. Now, that case was resolved because later on there was another threat. If I can't get my satisfaction any other way when I get out of here, I will just have to kill him. The investigating officer got him to invert the comments so the him became clear. It applied to both the two people that were
threatened.
Isn't
destroy your life kind of like kill you?
Ma'am, destroy your life, it could be interpreted to mean several things, I think. But
wouldn't that be then up for the fact finder to decide what it means?
I think so. Let me put it this way: as the sole determiner of the weight and credibility of the evidence, it is for the fact finder to determine what it means. But what we have in this case, unlike in Doyle, that I think is very important. And this visual aid, I'm going to apologize for. You can't read these comments. The purpose I put it up here.
is the timeline. These are the events of January, starting on the 8th and the end of January along the x-axis. And the reason I marked them up is because, with reference to our briefs and the record, you can parse out.
You might want to turn the microphone back around towards you if you're going to talk over here, so that if somebody wants to listen to this. I didn't either. Anyway, go ahead.
Best I can do. I'll try to speak loudly. But the threats in this matter, if you look at the record, and I'll try to put this in my reply brief, you have threats in December, an undetermined point in 2010. Prior to that, you had them throughout the month of January, and they involve unemployment line, threats of getting someone fired, threats of litigation, threats of taking things to the media. They involve a great number of different kinds of threats that are interspersed with references by the appellant to, and this goes back to Kevin Taylor's discussion with the appellant on January 8th and prior back in December, regarding problems he's having with his wife accessing his password, with his wife, with someone else in Oklahoma, and the reason he feels he is under a lot of stress, and the reason he feels that he needs to carry a firearm at all times. That's the context of the comment from Justice Gabriel that you're asking. I'll make a move to destroy your life as a comment. It is made on January 31st on a cell phone conversation in the context of, a 20-minute cell phone conversation with Wayne Aiken, during the course of which the state has chosen to parse out two forward phrases, one 13-word sentence, the one you mentioned, and, three forward phrases. In a 20-minute conversation, parse them out and asks you to put them together with airplane glue so that you can infer intent from them. Now, make a move to destroy my life. I'm licensed in 26 states, which occurs in the context of a conversation, which is about that he just had his weapon confiscated by the police department when he was arrested on the 28th, and he would like to get that, like to get his weapon back because of the police. He has a right to have it. That they confiscated his weapon, and that in Durant, he refers back throughout these mentions of a gun. In Durant, Oklahoma, he fears for his life, and that's why I carry it. The man's making an explanation. The state chooses to lift these several terms out to string them together to give them a meaning that is totally different than what a jury rationally could have inferred into the man. Now, make a move to destroy my life has to be subject to specific intent. Now, the law doesn't say it has to be an unequivocal expression of intent. It's got to be something very close. Now, I don't know what the measuring stick is that determines how close it needs to be, but if you review the jurisprudence, I challenge you to find another case where there is this pattern of conduct over time, and we employ a totality test to parse out different words and phrases in exclusion of the others so that we can get to make a move to destroy your lives, meaning a threat of physical violence. An unlawful threat whatsoever. How do we get there? How does this not mean something else that's lawful? It pertains to litigation, it pertains to employment, it pertains to, media. Having the media get attention to the AT&T store, Kevin Taylor and Lane Aiken. How do we reasonably mean further?
But isn't the jury's job to take the totality of the evidence that is admitted and determine what was meant by the statements over time? They heard them all. They could decide and make a decision. How is it unreasonable for them to assume that his threat that I'm going to get my nine and come to your store, and meaning his gun, and I'm going to destroy your lives, how is it unreasonable for them, under our standard of review, to determine that the state met their burden of proof?
Yes. General intent, the conduct of the appellant would support exactly what you're saying. But what we know about result-oriented intent is that it's two-part intent. The first being general intent, which focuses on the threat or the conduct made. The second being the what we call the result-oriented intent, or in the treatises, the specific intent, which requires that the defendant meant, and it is demonstrated that the defendant meant, to engage in the fitting consequence of inhibiting, or that it's reasonably certain that it can be demonstrated that it's reasonably certain, demonstrated by the evidence, that he
to engage in a prohibited specific consequence. As a specific intent crime, we narrow the statute to a reserve status that is limited only to those persons that are protected, those persons protected in statutory class. And that's another problem. They say that on the 24th and the 28th, you have a line drawn in the dirt that they're put on notice by, hey, we reported this to the police. Look at the record. That's not clear. That they aren't even put on notice to the police by a line drawn in the dirt. What's said on the 24th? Well, the 24th is a conversation in the context of which Lane Aitken says, I think I probably opened our courtroom to WFU. I think I probably isn't good enough. Or
reasonable doubt. And then he says, I think I will file. I told him, if you keep this up, I'll file harassment charges. That's perspective. He hasn't done it yet, and he doesn't keep it up.
But he was barred from the property, and he was arrested, and his gun was confiscated by the police. That pretty much nailed it, putting him on notice that they were filing charges, does it not? Or that they had reported him to the police?
I think one of the problems in the context here, the elephant in the room, is that every witness in this case is an AT&T employee, including the police officers who are functioning as part-time paid security for AT&T at the time of arrest. So I think it's telling that you don't have any, this is not a unlawful arrest, resisting arrest, a assault on a police officer charge. You don't have any of those files in this case. So on the 24th, well, we already discussed what was said. On the 28th, yes, Kevin Taylor's standing out in front of the store with the security guard or the officer, whatever it is, and he's barred. So are we to say then that Kevin Taylor is deemed to be a person who has reported conduct of crime to the police? Because you can't blur those two statutory categories together, which is pretty necessary. Are we to say he's a prospective witness in a criminal mischief case that the state's brief says might potentially be brought, but hasn't been, and there's no reason necessarily to think it will be, so because he hasn't been back to the store again after so which of the statutory categories, they've alleged all of them, but we have to decide, I think, which of the statutory categories he narrowly fits into. And I'm not sure that you can fit either one of them into it. But that's...
Well, they don't have to prove one of them. If they alleged all of them in their indictment, one juror could think they proved one and two jurors could think they proved another.
Yes, ma'am, but you have to prove which statutory category is to each specific defendant.
Was there any objection to the charge? Because I don't think the charge required that, did it?
The law requires it. I mean, there's several cases, and I don't know if I can pull one out of my mind right now. But there are several cases that say you have to prove a specific statutory class as to the defendant threat. But I think again, Justice, that the intent is where we live and die on this. And you asked me about a specific intent. And I would say that it has to be very nearly an unequivocal expression of intent. And in all the cases you'll find where intent is inferred, there's, for example, I think there's a case just about a year ago where there's nonverbal conduct which is alleged to be threatening, which clearly, in and of itself, doesn't constitute, could not sufficiently constitute threat supporting the inference of an intent to retaliate, but then a couple of days later, the guy says specifically with regard to the French person, the judge, I'm going to go get that person. And it seems to be imminent because immediately everyone goes to call the judge. So I think in that kind of a case, it's clear because you have nonverbal conduct of threat, nothing else in the record with regard to what happened between these two people. Find another case ever that entails all of these threats of litigation in the larger context of a customer relations dispute between AT&T's customer relations and then its security and then the customer over time, where he's saying inappropriate things, no doubt. I think the most persuasive thing to ask here is, you know, this is an assault by threat. That's what it is. Landry, which is cited in our brief, breaks down what happens when you charge a retaliation case as an assault by threat case, given it's a great discussion, better than I can. Given the requirement of specific intent in Texas resulting in rate of intent, assault by threat is what it should have been charged as. Why was it? We were sitting around brainstorming in the coffee shop and some of the public defenders involved in this case, and we tried to determine what charges could colorably have been brought against the defendant. Now, not which charges you would convict, but you're saying that you could charge him with these. But the elements might have been supported by the evidence. Retaliation is not one. There were eight. What do those charges have in common? Resisting arrest, assault by threat, etc. Harassment, which is one that the witness testified he was going to bring against the defendant, maybe in the future. What do they have in common? Well, they're misdemeanors. This man had played himself because he believed he had an issue with regard to customer service. He made a plague of himself for a period of over a month. Now that involved plenty of contemptible conduct, but what we know is, in every case where intent is to be inferred, what we know is, the rule is, the court does not focus on the nature of the conduct, however contemptible. Does not focus on the nature of the conduct, however contemptible. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greenwood. Mr. Foss.
Ladies and gentlemen, as Mr. Greenwood correctly stated, we're here today. Appellant is arguing that there's not legally sufficient evidence that a retaliation was committed. And he's correctly stated the Jackson standard, that it's any rational juror would have to find all the elements beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's interpreting all the facts in the light most favorable to the verdict, which would be a guilty verdict in this case. Couple things I just want to point out in the appellant's reply brief, which was filed this previous Thursday. It appears that Mr. Greenwood has tried to suggest some other standards that aren't the case. On page 8, he says that evidence supporting retaliatory intent must clearly establish in retaliation for on account of. Once again, we're here on this any rational trier of fact. That's the standard here. Also direct the court to page 10 of appellant's reply brief, where it says appellant's conduct, no matter how culpable or accumulated, is irrelevant to the court's analysis. And I don't know how the appellant's conduct, his words, it's all very relevant in considering this offense that the defendant committed. In the original brief, one thing I do agree with is that at the end of his reply brief, he states that appellant can reasonably be deemed irate, threatening, and potentially dangerous. I think that's what the retaliation is. Can lead to other more serious crimes, and that's why this is a serious crime that we're here for today. And the purpose of the retaliation statute is to encourage a certain class of citizens to perform vital public duties without fear of retribution. Now, just kind of walk the court through a brief timeline of the facts. January 12th, appellant talks to Mr. Taylor about carrying a firearm at AT&T. And at this point, AT&T starts stationing officers and as a result of this appellant's conduct. January 13th, he's on the phone with Brandon Haynes, an employee of AT&T, and he said, where he makes a comment, he would go to the store and take care of the situation. He would bring his 9 and go to the store. He was angry, he was upset. But I would also point out that this threat wasn't a specific threat against any individual. It was a general threat at this point. And Haynes responded to that, "We take threats seriously." He was telling them, "I understand that your conduct is threatening and we take that seriously." So the appellant knew what he was saying was threatening, was intimidating people. January 24th, Mr. Aiken has a phone conversation with the appellant and said that, once again, his threats were starting to frighten the employees. And he said that the appellant should have no contact with Mr. Taylor and that if he continued to do so, he would file harassment charges and that he would possibly get arrested if that were to happen. And court can read the record, but I believe that when he says, I told him that I contacted the police, that taking that in the light most favorable to the verdict, we can interpret that he did tell the police that. January 28th, the appellant comes up to the AT&T store. Mr. Taylor's present with an officer of the Wichita Falls Police Department. And he bars the appellant from the store. And the appellant's response to that is to pull out his phone, take a picture, and say, you're going to regret this. He's upset that he was just barred. That's not in relation to anything else. That's related to what just happened. And shortly after he takes his picture, he goes, the officer is trying to get some more information from him, and he's arrested for unlawful carrying of a weapon the same day. And I think we can reasonably infer that he could interpret that to be that this report with the police ultimately led to him being arrested. And at that time, the penal code defines informant as a person who's communicated info to the government in connection with a government function. So when he communicated that information to the officer to have him barred, at that point, the appellant was on knowledge, was on notice that he was an informant. He'd made a report to the police. And also that he was a prospective witness in any future criminal trespass case if the appellant were to choose to go back there. January 31st, the phone conversation between Lane Aiken and the appellant. He was upset. He mentioned the weapon several times. He'd mentioned that he'd been to jail, and he mentioned that he was going to meet with detectives. And then that's when he said he was going to make a move to destroy Aiken and Taylor's life. And I would direct the court to appellant's brief, which suggests that the threat was only against, at that time, Mr. Aiken, but the record's clear that it was a threat directed against Mr. Aiken and Mr. Taylor. So the facts, and this was the first threat that was communicated directly to Mr. Aiken. He'd made some threats previously, and the appellant, you know, these threats are more civil nature. I'm gonna get you fired, I'm gonna have people coming up here, those types of things. But so this is a different threat. It's a violent threat. It's a specific threat against two individuals. The previous threats were threats of the civil type of nature, but these threat, and they were, and the threat about bringing the nine was a general threat. These threats were specifically against these two specific people. Appellant knew that that Mr. Aiken had reported him to the police 7 days before he makes this statement. And 3 days before he's arrested after being barred from the store. So he knows that 7 days before Mr. Aiken had reported him to the police, 4 days after that, he was barred from the store and he's arrested for unlawful carrying of a weapon.
Does it make a difference that the statement or alleged threat on both employees was made only to the one employee?
No, and threats do not have to be directly communicated to, a threat can be communicated to one person and then that still carries over. It doesn't have to be, I don't have to specifically threaten one person, specifically threaten the other. For instance, if a person made a threat and someone were to overhear that threat, that would be significant as long as the other elements were met. So, and I believe the appellant's brief doesn't dispute that.
So the specific intent doesn't have to be directed toward that particular person?
Well, and it would certainly be a stronger case where the threats directly communicate against the person, but the fact that these two people were both employees of AT&T, I believe that it was his intent to tell Mr. Aiken so that then he would go on and tell Mr. Taylor that he would tell Mr. Taylor about the threat so as to intimidate him for making this report to the police. And I think in this, and so that example that I talked about where a threat is made, let's see, I've got a case. Well, there's one of the cases initially where the situation where the appellant makes a threat in the hallway, and then a lawyer overhears that and reports it to the judge. And the court held that this takes it a step farther, because a threat is made specifically to Mr. Aiken. So he wanted him to know what he was saying. So we can reason, the question ultimately is whether or not a rational jury could infer, could find the element of intent beyond a reasonable doubt. And the fact, the time proximity, the appellant stated in his brief that the state has choose to pick certain facts, but the violent threats are made closer to the time when he's in jail. And so we can infer that based on that time proximity, the threats are related to him being put in jail and in retaliation for making the reports to the police officer being prospective witnesses in the harassment cases or a criminal trespass case. And we can also, and this isn't a dispositive issue, but we can interpret how Mr. Taylor interpreted the threat. And Mr. Taylor packed up his family and he moved from Wichita Falls as a result of this, and that's stated in the record. He also stated he remains concerned with what the appellant would do. And so so obviously the appellant's purpose, his intent, or at least knowledge, it worked. It got him to move. The threat got through to Mr. Taylor.
Well, apparently it didn't work because Mr. Taylor was there to testify against him at his trial.
Correct.
If that's the specific intent, not to get him to move from the town.
You're correct, Your Honor. But it did have at least an effect to intimidate Mr. Taylor. Now, as far as addressing the appellant's second and third point, I think the second point can kind of be addressed once we address the third, but the specific language, destroy your life, this court knows that with a legal sufficiency case, since we're viewing everything in the light most favorable to the verdict, conflicting inferences are resolved in favor of the verdict. So if we've got one interpretation of destroy being civil or whatever, it's clear that another interpretation of the word destroy would be to kill. And the dictionary, the second definition that I found and is cited in the brief, defines destroy as put out of existence or kill. So interpreting in the light most favorable to the verdict, that would have to be interpreted as kill. And then the second, and obviously shooting or killing someone is an unlawful act. So the fact that destroy would be interpreted as kill, and kill would be an unlawful act, so that would take care of the second and third issues. Ultimately, the defendant's or the appellant's conduct demonstrated this isn't the reasonable hypothesis test where we can infer that he was upset about other things. We absolutely could infer. There's other explanations for why he could be upset. It's just whether, in the light most favorable to the verdict, a rational jury could find the intent element in this case. And his escalating conduct and the fact that he, he didn't specifically threaten anybody until after, in close in time after, they'd made reports to the police, shows that the reason why he was making those threats was because of that purpose. And if there's no questions at this time, I'd ask the court to affirm the judgment and give some of my time back.
I have one question. It's just because I'm curious. I don't think it has anything to do with anything, but was this a verdict of 11 jurors? Because 11 jurors signed the verdict form, which I thought was curious.
And I actually did not sit on the actual trial itself. If the verdict is signed by 11 jurors, then probably but I don't know for a fact, so.
Okay, like I said, I was just curious. Thank you.
I thank this court for giving me the opportunity to argue here this morning.
All right, thank you, Mr. Foss. Mr. Greenwood, rebuttal?
I'd like to try to cover a couple of the points that Matt raised. Excuse me, Mr. Foss. We used to work together, so we know each other. I slip up like that. First, I would point out that it's important to remember, I think, with regard to specific intent, result-oriented intent, that this not the standard here is intentionally or knowing. This is not recklessness. It's not what he should have known when he made all those comments. And we know also, and this is related to the much of the content of the state's brief and some of the comments that Mr. Foss made up here a moment ago, the appellant knew what he was saying, it in fact worked because he moved. All that's conduct-based and cannot properly be considered. And the reason for that is because specific intent, result-oriented intent, looks solely to the mind of the defendant. What the threatened party felt is irrelevant to the analysis. Now, that's not true with assault by threat, and Landrian discusses this. With assault by threat, you can look to the mind of the threatened party to determine if you can get intent in the mind of the defendant, not with retaliation, which is why there's not all that many cases, I think, in the jurisprudence, because it's so hard to prove. You can only prove it up as to the specific statutorily protected category of classes of people, and that's almost always a situation where someone's testifying at trial, someone's in the back seat of a squad car leaving the scene. It's a judge in court, and the person makes the statement soon after leaving court. It's a juvenile center or a school, and the statement is made, or the conduct is almost immediately following the conduct in the school, and then is supported by a direct statement that is unequivocal. If you look at the cases, you've got to have more to link, and I think this is, I think Justice Gabriel went right to it. This is what it's got to come down to, is to make a move to destroy comment. But in order to figure out how what significance that may have to infer intent, you've got to look at the whole pattern of conduct over a month. And why do you? Well, first of all, because the state predicates its case on that. They do so by asking you to parse out the events on the 24th and the 31st in a closed universe in which they lift only certain phrases which are especially damning conduct and the fact that he was arrested with a gun in his pocket, a sidearm. And then, after you've determined that there is a retaliatory intent, they skip in their brief back to the first part of the month, and they ask you,
look at all this other contemptible conduct, decide if you've got enough mud to throw at the wall to convict this guy of specific intent offense, which is what the jury did, and which I think is why I broke before in the appellate court, because you guys can parse out the significance of the statute and jurisprudence in a way. You know, justices, I think, justices, juries try to do what's right. They try to do justice. But when you start meeting them specific intent versus general conduct intent, that's a lot for them to be able to deal with. Now, Taylor stated on the period 8th through the, I believe it was the 17th, no, it was through the 22nd, I'm good at bracketing down here, that he was threatened on almost a daily basis in some way or another by the company. Because the guy was in there and he was complaining in his manner. Was threatened. Some of the statements he made could be interpreted as threats conceivably by a jury, you know, under the standard of Jackson. But they're sparse and throughout, they're interspersed throughout, peppered, whatever my word is there, with comments regarding a media shitstorm coming. We're going to start seeing a lot of unwanted visitors in here, lawyers in the context of litigation scenario, or maybe they're armed bandits, I don't know. But going to lose your job, I'll see you in court. He's unusually angry in his manner, in his conversation. Make a move to destroy here on the 31st, in the final conversation. How do you parse that out as an angry comment that's made in the heat of a conversation with a person who just got out of jail, given specific intent as the standard? At the same time, by looking at his conduct throughout the month, and just closing your eyes to all of these other things that were discussed in the course of that. Can you infer can you reasonably infer a threat to shoot or kill given the standard, the specific intent of the law? Get to it. I only discuss the first comment in the law, or I only discuss the significance of it, or Dan gives one when I get out of here, I'll just have to get a gun. If I can't get my satisfaction any other way, when I get out of here, I will kill him. The second comment was deemed insufficient under the standard result-oriented intent to convict. I will kill him. It was only because the referent of him was able to be made during interrogation back to
or Dan Gibbs, a Dallas County commissioner and a judge. In that case, the court said, even if you have a specific and unequivocal explicit statement that I will kill somebody, that's not going to be good enough unless you have more. Now, if Doyle, if these comments, and this is all in dicta, but they were saying how they would hold had this been the case, if Doyle doesn't float, this boat certainly won't. Because in Doyle, all you had was somebody.
Conclude your thought.
Thank you. I'm sorry, when you go back and forth, in Doyle, all you had was a guy who was going down to commit an assault for retaliation and said so eventually on a Dallas City commissioner and a judge. You didn't have anything else that wasn't parsed out over a month and more. You didn't have all this other stuff going on. It wasn't a customer relations scenario. There were no alternative possibilities as to what might have been meant. And while alternative, he's mad adequately, Mr. Foss states in his brief, while alternative possibilities are subject to the resolution of the jury, they aren't as to determining whether there was specific intent, a result-oriented intent, when we don't even know clearly when the report to police was made in relation to the conduct, which was the same on either side of when the alleged reports were supposedly maybe made and who would have known at what moment. Thank you. I'm sorry I've run over my time.
Thank you, Mr. Greenwood. Mr. Foss, we thank you for your arguments. We appreciate all your briefing in this matter, and your case is now submitted, and you all are excused. We'll proceed to our fourth case on the docket.